This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Joining me on the Jodcast today is Professor Richard Davies from the University of Manchester. Hello and welcome back to the Jodcast.
Hello, I'm pleased to be here.
The last time you talked to us on the Jodcast, Planck had just been launched. Can you fill us in a bit more about what you've been doing since then?
Yes, well, the fantastic thing is it all went up and worked. At the time of the launch, we had no idea whether the instrument was working, because it wasn't switched on. It didn't get switched on for about another 20 days. And I was present at the data processing centre in Trieste. And when we switched our amplifiers on, there are 20 amplifiers altogether. And it took us 2 days to switch them on, because we had to be in contact with the spacecraft when that happened. And that happens over a 2-hour period every day. So it took us 4 hours to switch them all on. And it was very, very exciting. When we last ran the amplifiers, had been in CSL, Centrale Spatiale Liège, in a big cryostat as big as my house, cooled down to 4 Kelvin. And so we knew the performance of all the amplifiers, and when we switched them on in space, I was astonished to find that even though they were now nearly a million miles from the Earth, every single one of them turned on with the currents and voltages within 1% of how they'd performed in the laboratory at Liège. And given what had happened to them, it was very exciting.
So with 1% of what you were testing, the performance was as expected in space?
So this was just the current through the transistors. At that stage, we hadn't actually measured the performance as radiometers. But I'm happy to say that they all worked. I must admit, I thought we might lose about 10%. If you just looked at other people having tried to build radiometers, that's about the sort of figure that had been achieved. In fact, all 20 worked. There are 8,000 bond wires that join the whole thing together, and it was built by our technician, Eddie Blackhurst. But Eddie didn't want to do the checking, which is quite right, so somebody had to check all these bond wires, and so it fell to me to check all 8,000 of them. And having checked all those, I thought, well, what's the chance of all those still working when it launched? Well, they did. It must say something about this space qualification. I think we had some luck as well. Let's be serious here.
Well, it seems like that was very successful with everything working as you expected. Can you tell us just a bit more in general about the instrument that you were helping design?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit more about the launch for a start. What we didn't know is how accurately the Ariane rocket had managed to post Planck into its correct orbit. The Ariane rocket was responsible for it getting there. There were some small motors on Planck that then decelerated it to put it into the L2 orbit. But there was quite a margin for error as to how accurately it would do that. And so there was quite an amount of fuel on Planck that could be used if it was in the wrong place. It could be correct and put it into the right place. In fact, the Ariane did a perfect job. It actually, we didn't know this at the time, we didn't learn for a few weeks, that it had actually put it into a perfect orbit, which means that we've actually got enough propellant on Planck to run it for 20 years. We're not intending to run it for 20 years, but it's that good. But it has meant that even though HFI could only run for 2.5 years, and that was the design life, because it loses its helium-3 that's required to cool it down. The LFI, the low-frequency instrument, the one that I was involved with, is recyclable and could, in principle, last for a lot longer. And so far, we've been running for 4 years. So the nominal mission was only meant to be 1 year, so we've run it for 4 years. So those of you who know about observing time versus sensitivity, 4 times longer means you get double the sensitivity. So the performance of the LFI, we have things called requirements and goals. And the requirement is you have to promise to meet the requirement. That's the aim. And then if you're really, really lucky, you try and achieve the goals, which are actually considerably higher in sensitivity. And the good news is that Planck, the LFI, now has reached its goal, not only reached its requirements, but reached its goals. The HFI reached its goals almost immediately and has worked beautifully. So both cameras have performed fantastically. So the data we've got is really quite astounding. And I'll be showing it to all the scientists here in Manchester tomorrow as the press is released. But I can't talk about those actual cosmological results at this stage. But the performance of the machine is well published, and so I'm quite free to talk about any of that. Of course, we're absolutely overjoyed. I mean, I've worked on this machine for 18 years. I'm able to measure it by my son's age, because I started working on it when he was born, and he's 18 years old, so I'm able to get that right every year. I just have to remember my son's birthday.
And per year, how much of the sky does it map?
So it sees the whole sky every 6 months. So it's in an orbit called L2, which is 1 million miles away from the Earth. So it's 4 times further away than the moon. It used to touch me sometimes when I was handling the bits and pieces of the equipment to think, this thing's going 4 times further away than Neil Armstrong. it hadn't quite twigged that this was, it's a truly, truly amazing thing that it's going to, that it did.
And what type of objects is the low frequency array looking at?
So it's a survey instrument, and so, as I say, within 6 months we survey the whole sky. It's a heliocentric orbit. We rotate round the sun at the same rate as the Earth, the same angular rate. So if you imagine the line joining the sun and the Earth and Planck, that always remains in a straight line as the year continues. Planck itself is looking, it has the Earth and the moon and the sun behind it. It's looking in the cold direction. And so as the year progresses, so the spacecraft is looking at different regions of the sky. It's spinning, and so it is able to survey the whole of the sky every 6 months. So 4 years will actually complete 8 surveys.
And will you? You said you have 20 more years worth of fuel, but you won't run it for that long. How long do you envision it being run for?
This is a problem, because it does cost quite a bit of money to run it, because it's just the manpower on the ground and running the data links, the communication with the spacecraft. It is quite expensive. And anyway, it has been agreed that we're running it for 4 years. 4 years actual observing, so that's like 4 years and 3 months, because we spent 3 months getting there and getting it all tuned up and working. Beyond that, nothing else is agreed. The thing that will probably limit it is a machine called the sorption cooler. This is the most expensive, miserable refrigerator you can imagine. It has a cooling power of 1 watt. It has no moving parts. It works just by heating and cooling. Palladium metal, and the hydrogen comes out of the palladium when you heat it and goes into the palladium when it cools down. And in that way, you can make a compressor and also enable the gas to expand and contract. And this actually cost $40 million. And there are two of those on board, and they have a limited life. But the king is dead, long live the king. These things can be regenerated. What happens is the palladium metal decays and starts to become a powder. But if you heat it hot enough, it can regenerate into the proper metallic state again. This has been done on the ground, but it's never been done in space. So we are going to regenerate later this year, and we don't know how much life there will be left in it. Looking on the good side, we have got funding to run it for till August, which will make the end of the fourth year.
Now that the high-frequency array is no longer working in counterpart with the low-frequency array, do they have very different science goals that you can achieve?
Well, both instruments are surveying the sky. The low-frequency instrument works from 30 to nearly 100 gigahertz, and the high-frequency instrument works from 100 gigahertz to 857. The problem we have to observe the microwave background is to find regions where we can look where we don't see the foregrounds, the so-called emission from the galaxy. And these foregrounds come to a minimum around 70 gigs, 70 gigahertz. Above that, you get thermal dust. On the 6 months date of the first survey, which is published, I'm sure many people of you have seen that, the white stuff is the 857 gigahertz. That's all thermal dust emission. At very low frequencies, we see radiation from the galaxy called synchrotron radiation and free radiation. And so we try and go for the region in between. But we need all the frequency channels so we can subtract these foregrounds out, which enables us to see the microwave background in great detail. But when you study these foregrounds, you have to study them in great detail to be able to subtract them out accurately. A lot of the processes for subtracting these things out are only good to about 30%, and we need significantly better than 0.1%.
Is this due to the sensitivity and resolution that Planck's been able to do, that you need this extra detail to get rid of the foregrounds?
Indeed. But what happens, of course, when you study something in such detail, you start getting interested in it for its own right. And this is an area where the University of Manchester, Jodrell Bank, JBCA, is leading the world. It really stems from the time of Rod Davies, who is still with us, and he's very much, he was the first co-I to the Planck project, and it was him who invited me to come and join in this project. Now, he's got an interest in galactic astronomy that goes back for some 65 years, so a very, very long period of time he's been interested. And I often joke that if you took Rod out into the galaxy and dropped him off, he'd find his way back, because he has a three-dimensional model of the galaxy in his head.
So some results already for Planck have already been published. Can you tell us some about these results?
Okay. Well, I've mentioned the synchrotron radiation at low frequency and the free thermal Bremsstrahlung, and I've mentioned thermal dust at high frequency. And so we all thought, great, we'll go and observe around 30, 40 gigahertz, which is where our LFI frequencies are. And would you believe, just when you thought it was safe to come out at night, we've discovered a new foreground. It's called anomalous dust. We call it anomalous dust because the pattern of it on the sky looks the same as the thermal dust. But it's too bright. It's at these low frequencies, the thermal dust has become very, very faint. And it's sort of 500 times brighter than the thermal dust.
So the thermal dust is very, very, very cold dust.
Yes, it is cold dust, that's right. So this anomalous dust, we think, must be associated with the dust. In fact, for a long time, we've wondered, and Ron has been very keen on this idea, that it might be spinning dust. So this is just like particles being in equilibrium with photons, picking up their energy, vibrating. So also, dust particles can spin. It's a remarkable thought that these little tiny dust grains, about the size of a naphthalene molecule, that's mothballs, for those of you who know about these things, these molecules have got 50 carbon atoms in, and with an infrared photon hitting them, they can spin at 30 gigahertz. And if these molecules, which naphthalene is, are asymmetric in their electron distribution, then when you spin such a molecule, it looks like a little oscillating dipole, and they radiate by electromagnetic radiation. And the spectrum that you get matches very well with the spectrum. And this is what Planck has done very nicely, and this result is published, showing unequivocally that the spectrum really fits very, very well with the spinning dust.
That's a really cool discovery. So, you also have a piece of Planck a piece of design testing material for Planck. Can you tell us what you're holding and
yes.
what it does?
You must think I'm a little bit mad because I'm sat here with a wrist strap on connected to the mains. But in fact, the wrist strap is merely, the mains is really connected to the earthing pad. So I'm handling what we call the qualification model. This was the last model we made before we built the bits that actually flew. So this is as close as we could get to the actual flight hardware. The transistors in here are so, the gates in them, the important parts, are so tiny that the static carried by a human being, particularly on these nylon carpets we have in here, would blow the transistors up. So I have to earth myself before handling any of it. The structure is a three-dimensional, I call it the Rubik Cube. It was designed by Frank Winder. I was absolutely amazed at this thing when he showed me the design. I'll show you on the computer screen in a moment. And it all went together. I thought we'd have to make loads and loads of these models before we got something that actually assembled properly. In fact, it all fitted together and worked. It was hardly changed between this qualification model and the system that actually flew.
What job is this model designed to do?
Okay, so this is one of the 30 gigahertz front-end modules. It takes in two signals of the two polarizations from the horn, which then goes to an ortho mode transition, producing the two polarizations. It also takes in two reference channels. We have to have a reference signal, and we use the body CAN of the HFI, which conveniently cools to 4.5 Kelvin. We'd rather have 2.7 Kelvin. We really want the same temperature as the microwave background as our reference signal, but 4.5 Kelvin is pretty close and turned out to be sufficiently close for us to get cancellation of what we call red noise, which is a problem that transistors have. It's a noise which increases the longer you wait. One of the problems that we get with 1/f noise is cleaners with the vacuum cleaners and air conditioning that comes on and goes off during the day and night time and is different at the weekends. Of course, all that sort of thing disappears once you're in space, and so the hardware all worked much better than when it was on the ground, when all the human beings were out of the way. And of course, none of us were fiddling with it as well. I think that helped.
And the engineering involved in that is very detailed. How many of these were on the spacecraft?
Okay, so we flew 5 of them. We had a grant for £2.5 million. So in some sense, you could argue that each of them cost £500,000. And they were pretty well priceless to us because there wasn't sufficient time to build another one. Having built them all so carefully, what we did was put them in a, we packaged them up and put them in the back of one of the Jodrell Bank vehicles and drove them down to Rutherford Appleton Labs and shook them to pieces. Well, we didn't shake them to pieces, we shook them violently. But the rule now, after Apollo 13, one of the things to come for Apollo 13, because they damaged Apollo 13, one of the tanks with the testing. They actually tested it to destruction, so when they tried to use it, it blew up. We all know the Apollo 13 accident. And they modified how you do testing now of flight hardware. And that is the actual flight hardware. You don't push it up to the same level as the rocket vibrations. You do it less. What they used to do was actually test. They tested things without realizing it, virtually to destruction. But we had, it was still frightening. You couldn't be in the room when the vibrator was on because it would have blown your eardrums.
Wow.
And we used to measure the radio performance of these pieces of equipment before we shook them, and then measure them after we'd shaken them, and we never saw any change whatsoever. The only thing we did see is we measured the vibration frequencies, so so-called eigenfrequencies, for those who are theoretically minded. And these eigenfrequencies just changed a little bit in the first few seconds. And because this is actually made of lots of different bits and pieces all screwed together, I think the bits and pieces just settled in slightly. There must have been microscopic movements, so the frequencies just changed slightly. The reason for the shaking is to make sure that nothing's going to fall off, because when you put your piece of equipment on the spacecraft, it's vital that nothing falls off and damages any other piece of equipment.
Are they tested individually as well as all combined together, or is it just an individual testing?
So each one of these combined FEMs were tested en bloc. We didn't test the pieces inside, but we did test each FEM separately. And incidentally, it cost us £1,000 to test each one. The vibrator that it goes on, we had to rent for a day. It looked rather funny because I think you could have put a small tractor on the vibrator, and to see our little tiny cube, which we'd had prepared so carefully over the previous months and years, to put it on this vibrator. But of course, worse was to come. We were to stick it on a lorry and drive it to down to Laban in Italy, and then from there went to CSL in Belgium, then to S-Labs in Noordwijk in Holland, and then on an Antonov aircraft, the big Russian aircraft, and flown to Kourou in Central America, and then onto the top of the Ariane rocket and blasted into space. And all I can say is when the solid fuel rockets go off on the Ariane, it's rather similar to the space shuttle. It's just like an explosion. And the thing was blasted a million miles away. And to, even to this day, I still find it amazing to think that it all worked after everything that was done to these poor little things, which were like little jewels to us.
Because they're about 5 centimetres by about 3 centimetres?
Yes, it's like 2 Swan Vesta boxes of matches, isn't it? That's
about Yeah. They're not very big.
The thing
big.
I'm holding is quite heavy because it's made of brass and then got, it's gold-plated. What we actually flew was made of aluminium. One of the problems is you can't gold-plate aluminium. But we discovered you can nickel-plate it. And then after nickel-plating, you can gold-plate it. So you had to have a multiple coating system. I used to have nightmares about space qualification. But having said all that, all this process of space qualification, and I did say a bit of luck, has resulted in the machine all operate, all of it worked, all the bits that we built, and they're all still working as I speak now.
Was there any other thing that you were building beyond these that you're holding now?
Oh, well, it's this, what I hold here, is one of the amplifiers. And the amplifiers have got 2 sides. The actual RF side, the radio frequency side. So this is the 30 gigahertz amplifier. And one end, the signals go in and they come out the other end. And there's a line, a transmission line through the middle. And you can see where the 4 transistors would fit. And then on the back is all the circuitry associated with the biases, the DC voltages, if you like, what your batteries would deliver if this was a transistor amplifier of your own. And the wiring is all done with bond wires, which are little gold wires that are thinner than a human hair, and they are attached to the reason now you'll be able to explain why we need these surfaces gold plated, because the bond wires are attached to everything because it's gold to gold, and what happens is you melt the gold into the other gold and the two regions fuse together. It's called bonding, and you bond by heat and by pressure. Now the pressure is somewhat hair-raising. It turns out the pressure is about one oil tanker per cubic meter. An oil tanker weighs about 100,000 tons. I used to joke with Eddie that was the load that he was applying. So that the tip of this bonding probe that was used here was only a few microns across. And so although it's exerting a pressure of 100,000 tons per square meter, that pressure, the actual weight, if you like, on the tip was only 6 grams. But that was equivalent to a pressure. But that was sufficient to melt the gold wire into the gold. And that was the quality of that melt was all important. That was the thing that determined whether the bond wires would stay on or fall off.
And it seems like you've done a very good job with everything.
Well, I think it was my team of technicians and engineers. I was the one who went out and got the grant. As I say, I did do the job of checking all the bond wires. And there are, you can work it out yourself, there are 200 bond wires on the back and there are 200 bond wires on the front. So that makes 400 bond wires in each amplifier, and there are 20 amplifiers. And I think if you multiply 400 by 20, you get 8,000. So that's my calculation of 8,000 bond wires.
Wow, and they're so tiny to check everything.
Well, the transistors themselves are invisible. And I don't know how Eddie did it. If they were in a gel pack, and if you held up the gel pack to a bright light, you could just see them as, in each, there were little 2 millimetre squares. And in the middle of each 2 metre square, if you held them up to the light, you could just see a tiny fleck of gold. And that tiny fleck of gold was the transistor. And Eddie could pick those up with a pair of tweezers and carry them across and glue them into the circuit. And this tiny fleck that you could barely see had got something like 10 pads on it, 10 connections. And he could then bond wires to these 10 pads under a microscope by hand. He was bonding the wires by hand onto the transistor. Yes, it's a dark art being able to put these things together. But you see now why I was so worried about losing some of these. We've never actually lost a bond wire on any of these amplifiers. We did lose them in the early days. What we had to do was do what we called a docket. So before we started bonding, Eddie would bond some wires to a surface of gold, and then he'd pull them off. And he would measure the force that he needed to pull the wires off. And they all had to meet this level. So he would check that his bonder was working properly by doing this docket, pulling them off, check they were all okay. Then he'd do his bonding, and then he'd do another docket. He had to test the bonder before he started bonding, do the bonding, and then test the bonder after and check that it was still performing just the same. So in that way, we were confident that the wires that had been bonded would stay on.
Well, thank you very much for showing me that the test modules. It's excellent and really fascinating. And very scary that you're still kind of plugged up to the mains.
I think I'll switch myself off.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, and I look forward to finding out the results from Planck tomorrow.
Thank you.